Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Monday, June 25, 9 o'clock, which means all things political. A big week for the Supreme Court. We are awaiting word probably this hour as to whether or not the Supreme Court will announce their decision on the challenge to the Affordable Care Act today. They're going to tell us what they're going to do to announce today. It may be nothing, or it may be immigration, it may be health care, or it may be something else. So we'll keep you informed. Brett has his eyes and ears on the internet, and we'll be checking, and we'll let you know as soon as that happens. If the Affordable Health Care Act is announced, I'm sure we'll switch most of our conversation to that. We will, of course, cover it in our conversation with Jeffrey Lord, who is our guest this hour. Jeffrey is a contributing writer for The American Spectator. He also worked in both the Ronald Reagan and the George Bush White House, the first George Bush, and he is a former aide to Jack Kemp. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we look at this very busy week, very important week in America. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Jeffrey Lord, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning there, Kathleen. I must say, listening to your newscast, I'm not sure whether I'd rather be waiting for the Supreme Court or having strawberries and cream in Wimbledon, but we'll make do.
I know, maybe you could have been doing both, but instead, here we are waiting for the Supreme Court, which I understand, correct me if you have a different impression, that they will be soon announcing what they're going to announce today.
Exactly. I can tell you I have the television on without the sound.
Good.
There is the Supreme Court.
Oh.
And they are all waiting, and it will either, they're telling us that will either come in the next few minutes or it will be Thursday. So it will be this week for sure, whether it is today or not.
All right. Well, we'll go to that, of course, as soon as we know.
It'll be a contest between Brett and myself to see who tells you first.
What's the prize?
Strawberries and cream in Wimbledon and the champagne. I left that out.
You're funny. That's great. Before we, as we await this decision, can you, because you have the perspective of working in a couple different White Houses, let's just start with why it is that it's so difficult for this country to take on the issue of health care when obviously people of all political persuasions know that we have significant problems with health care delivery, with health care costs in America.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, Kathleen, I have been reading Robert Caro's new biography, the latest in his series
so
of biographies on Lyndon Johnson. And I'm just at the part about 500 pages in where he's become president and is sort of surveying the lay of the land. And Caro was talking about the difficulty that they have had getting past not just civil rights legislation, but minimum wage legislation. I mean, he runs through this whole long litany, JFK's tax cut, this kind of thing. And I would suggest that this is fairly typical of the American political system. It's done by design. It depends on whatever majority a president manages to muster with his initial election and then his skills or lack thereof at, picking up the phone and massaging the members of Congress and getting them to do his bidding.
Mm-hmm.
If you recall back in those days, LBJ had both a Democratic Senate and House and by fairly heavy margins. And yet, and frankly, that had been true for JFK as well, and with one exception, I think, where they had 2 years of a Republican Senate in House in Eisenhower's era, Ike was dealing with a Democratic Senate and House. So these problems have been going on for decades. And I do think that this is part of the systematic or the problem with the American, not problem. It's why the system was built the way it was. You know, our ancestors having all this fear of kings and King George and too much power and too much authority, so they deliberately split it up. So periodically this question gets asked, and as I'm reminded in reading this book, this was asked, you know, decades and decades ago when LBJ took over from John F. Kennedy. So it's being asked again, and I think it's the more complicated the issue, and healthcare is decidedly a complicated issue, the longer and the more difficult it is to resolve.
Should it be before the Supreme Court? Should the Supreme Court be telling us whether or not affordable health care is constitutional?
Well, I think they have a role to say whether it is or not. I think, frankly, whatever they say today, there's going to be a political challenge. This will become an immediate issue. If, in fact, the Obama administration loses, I have to believe they will take this to the campaign trail instantly, before the day is out, and ask the American public, in essence, to give him the, you know, to reelect him and to give him a Democratic House and Senate to pass it, you know, and they'll tinker with it to figure out, you know, how they can get it through the Supreme Court. If, on the other hand, it's rejected, I think that the Republicans will celebrate, but then they will also say, you know, these are the kind of things that we want to do in a different fashion, so we don't get this roadblocked by the Supreme Court. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is inevitable, and these decisions ultimately are resolved politically, not in courts.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sort of goes against the conventional wisdom here, but you know, if you look back at a big decision like the Dred Scott decision in 1857, well, we don't have slavery anymore. And they tried to write that into the Constitution, and that launched a whole series of things, of course, the Civil War. Now, I'm not saying anything as dramatic as that, but my point is that there is always resistance when there is not popular support. In our lifetime, I think the abortion issue, you know, that is still out there churning away long after Roe v. Wade, which is, what, January 1973. So, you know, these are battles for public opinion and public consensus. They're never pretty. They always happen. Eventually, there does come to be a consensus on something, but it does take time.
Mm-hmm. I spent the day Saturday moderating a breast cancer forum here in Milwaukee with a lot of scientists, and the whole room was filled with women who are living with breast cancer or a diagnosis. It's been in remission for a long time, or they're cured. And there was so much interest, and I must say concern, in that room about affordable health care. And then you read stories, as the one in the New York Times, I don't know if you saw that on Saturday, I think, or Sunday, the gentleman who had a tumor behind his knee and he didn't make enough money to get health insurance. The problem remains that there are so many human beings in this country who don't have access, who have limits on their coverage, who just are not getting the best care. And it seems to me as though we recognize that something was developed, but we're back to almost square one, unless Obama got, which is highly unlikely, a Democratic House and Democratic Senate. Why can't the parties get together and help people who are sick in this country? It is a huge issue for so many human beings. You know many, I'm sure, as well.
I do indeed.
Yeah.
I do indeed. I myself am busy taking care of my 93-year-old mom, whose birthday is today.
Oh, happy birthday to your mom.
And, well, thank you. Thank you. You know, we have faced, you know, she fell and all this kind of thing. So you're going through all of these healthcare things, and I can tell you it's an excruciatingly difficult thing to go through. So you're quite right on the human end of it. But again, you get into, and I was going to use the word partisan, but that somehow undignifies it here. Now, wait just a second. News alert. I'm looking at that screen. Awaiting Supreme Court decision. Okay, nothing yet. 10:15. That somehow, I think, is there are genuine differences over how to do this. And there is, certainly on my side of the aisle, there is this belief now that is to say it's set in stone would be to understate it, that when you give power in anything to the government, and the answer is to set up huge bureaucracies, that individuals quickly lose control of their own situation. This whole quote-unquote death panel issue there, the independent, I forget what its formal name is, the independent advisory panel or whatever, which in essence is going to advise on how to ration care, you run into roadblocks like that where people are genuinely fearful that they are losing control of their own lives. Nobody's disputing that we all need health care. The question is how to do it. And so therein, until we get this sort of consensus from the American people on this, this is going to drag on, and it is going to be a problem. There is just no question about it.
What about every other country in the world? Many of them have figured it out, haven't they?
Well, you know, if you listen again to people on my side, they say no. As a matter of fact, I haven't written about healthcare lately, but at one point when I was writing about it, I was looking at stories on the British healthcare system over there, and they had a situation which was in the news in Britain, which is exactly what terrifies so many people here, where a woman, and I forget what illness she had, and she went through their bureaucracy over there, and they basically said, well, she was in her 60s or 70s, and they basically said, well, this is too expensive, you're too old, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And she died.
Mm.
And, of course, her husband and family were just appalled. And this is exactly the kind of thing that tells you that these systems abroad do not work as well as they are cracked up to be working. I remember a story during the healthcare debate of how somebody on the Canadian side of the border needed some operation, and they came here instead of doing it in Canada. This is the heart of the problem. It's not that these problems are not serious. They are. Everybody's experiencing them in one form or another, whether it's, I mean, you name the disease. Healthcare has to be made accessible. The question is how to do it. And there is immense disagreement or sharp disagreement, let's say, over this. And I do think, frankly, we will see in terms of both the court's answer. Wait a second here. Supreme Court rules on Arizona's immigration law.
Oh, they did.
I don't know what the decision is, but they flash it up there. So that's not health care.
Okay.
So, you know, we will definitely see, I think, in the Romney-Obama situation, because, they're both imperfect vessels for their respective arguments, I suppose. But it's going to crystallize around those two guys. And then they're assorted candidates for, you know, House and Senate, et cetera. And then we'll see whether or not there is a consensus. But, you know, as unpretty as all of this is what a national discussion is. This is the figurative kitchen table of American politics with everybody sitting around having a discussion. And sometimes it takes years, decades, to come to decisions on some of these things.
And I thought, hey, we've had those discussions here for a good year and a half. We did forums. I had guests all the time. And now we're going to do it again. Mitt Romney. Does Mitt Romney have a complete position paper on health care? And if not, would it behoove him to come up with a very detailed plan?
Yeah, frankly, I honestly don't know whether he does. I mean, I know he wants to repeal Obamacare, and he of course, as was seen in the primaries, was attacked by Republicans for being, in essence, the father of Obamacare, or the stepfather of Obamacare, as it were, of affordable health. So I can't tell you off the top of my head whether he has put forward something on this, but he needs it. He's got mm-hmm. to have this, because this is at the I think close to the top of the list, probably below jobs. Jobs is always the issue in an American election, but somewhere in the top five, I would say, is health care without doubt, and definitely he will need to do that.
Yeah. Let's take phone calls. We have a full bank of phone lines at the moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also post a message on our Facebook page if you'd like to do that, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We find ourselves in a rather unique situation with the Supreme Court having these two major decisions coming down, and they are evidently announcing that they have a decision on the Arizona immigration law, so we'll probably get more information on that, but perhaps not giving us a decision on affordable health care today is the way I'm reading this. So we'll move to an immigration discussion as soon as we know what their ruling is. Our guest is Jeffrey Lord. Jeffrey is a contributing editor for the American Spectator, served in high-level positions in both the Reagan White House and the Bush White House. And we start our calls with Scott in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Well, yeah. I have a lot to say about healthcare, but I'll try and keep it short. I hope the Supreme Court overturns it because I think it's unconstitutional. But the reason I want it overturned, and this comes from a conservative, which I am, I the individual mandate was kind of a compromise because it at first wanted a business mandate where businesses paid for health insurance, and I think that's exactly the wrong thing. We need to take it, as an employer, we need to get it out of the employer's hands as our responsibility to pay for other people's health insurance. I think we should be, as a nation, all contributing, not just the rich or the middle class. Everybody should be contributing so we would have a universal system that we all contribute to and that we can all use. And at the same time, if individuals want personal private insurance, we should be allowed to do that also. Something similar to like public schools. We all contribute to public schools. We all have the ability to use public schools, but people that want to send their kids to private schools pay for that. I think that's the direction that we need to go.
Jeffrey, what do you think?
Well, I think that there, to some degree, that those are incompatible. I mean, to say, at least as I'm listening to you, to say universal health care, I mean, that's a buzzword for a government system, more along the lines of what the Brits have. And I think that is, a sort of total non-starter with people on our side. I have to say, I wonder with your caller why we dump this in the lap of businesses, and whether that is a good system to have, if there's not a better way to do this. But I think that's, frankly, that's the discussion right there. If we're not going to do the health care mandate, and if we're not going to do universal health care, then what do we do? And how do we do this? And how do we get to a situation where everybody pays for it? I mean, the concern here is not only health care, but the health of the long-term health of the nation in a constitutional sense. I mean, I can hear some of my more legally astute friends talking about what we're dealing with here are temporary American politicians who want to fundamentally change the relationship between the citizen and the government, and that's going to be a non-starter here, that they want to make sure that they get this sort of nailed down in a constitutional fashion, which certainly a lot of people feel the Affordable Health Care Act is not. So I think the universal health care thing is, I mean, talk about a red flag, that would be it. The rest of it, I think, is going to be interesting to see how we can come to grips with this.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. You are listening to All Things Political, and our guest today is Jeffrey Lord. Jeffrey writes for the American Spectator, has served in the Reagan White House and the Bush White House, and we're talking about health care because the Supreme Court is taking up that issue, going to give us their decision sometime this week. Brett tells me that it is known that there will be no health care decision today, so it will be tomorrow or the next day, and then they're pretty much done for the year. But nonetheless, it's an important issue for us to talk about. I want to also move into a conversation with Jeffrey about Marco Rubio. He's written extensively about him, the role of the vice presidency, whether or not Rubio, of course, a favorite of the conservative base of the party, would it be wise for Mitt Romney to put him in the VP slot or not? We'll ask that question. We'll talk about immigration. We'll talk about global warming. Somebody on the line wants to discuss that and much more in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls. Let me again tell you how you can reach us this morning. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page, open to you for your comments about what's happening. And we may use some of those on the air. And that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Linda in Bristol is our next caller. Hi, Linda.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment on the whole death panel issue. We already have a death panel, if you want to call it that, in particular for the people that don't have the money or aren't, employed with good health care plans. It wasn't that long ago, I believe, that Arizona ended up having to let some people die that had terminal conditions. There are also people that have health care insurance that are dismissed from coverage because they have, quote, pre-existing conditions. I've heard numerous stories. For example, there was a lady that had a mole, and she ended up with some completely different type of cancer. There's nothing wrong with the mole, and they said that it was a pre-existing condition because she had this mole. Many other situations, people are dumped you know, when the companies don't want to pay for it, people with pre-existing conditions, I would call that as well a death panel because they can't get coverage. So this whole fear-mongering about the government taking over and there being death panels, I think, is just an excuse. And, you know, once again, to me, the right side whipping up fear among their followers. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jeffrey.
Well, the difference here, I would say respectfully, is that you have competition in the private sector. I would certainly agree with you. Something has to be done about pre-existing conditions, and I think that there is, you know, considerable sentiment for that. But if you rule out a system where there's any appeal or any chance or any second chance, or in the president's words, well, you know, you're going to have to take the red pill, meaning, you know, that's it, because we can't afford to give you the a group of people in the government have decided that your grandmother can't, you know, it's not worth giving her the pacemaker. I think that was what the discussion that was held in the White House that was on ABC when this issue was first appearing. That's what hits a sensitive nerve here, is who in the government is so perfect to decide to ration care, to tell you that you must live or die because they think, you know, it doesn't fit the budget. I mean, there are plenty of ways to, I think, to come to grips with this issue, come to grips with the issue of pre-existing conditions and others. But, you know, handing over final authority to some government board to give thumbs up or thumbs down on somebody's health care situation is, I think, going to be a non-starter for a lot of people.
What about all of the people, Jeffrey, who don't have health insurance? How do we deal with that issue? And do we have to wait 10 years?
You know, Kathleen, if I knew the answer, I'd be running for president today. I think it is an enormously complex situation. As a conservative, I believe that the answer is to have as many health care options as possible, affordable health care options for people as possible, to have your own plan, your health care accounts and all this, where you can contribute over time. And I do think it's important, as your earlier caller had said, I certainly agree with him on this, that we all need to be contributing to our own health care in some form or fashion, in terms of, and I'm talking about financially here. But I do think that the answer lies in that direction, because once you go down this road, I mean, we've just seen this time after time after time after time, this to sort of segue for 2 seconds here into this whole Fast and Furious, take out all the personalities and everything else, what you've got is bureaucracy run amok on that issue. That kind of thing happens all of the time. And in knowing that, to sort of willfully hand over, you know, your health, your own personal health care situation to a government bureaucracy is for a lot of people a terrifying thought.
And yet people seem to like Medicare.
Well, they do. The only problem with Medicare is, of course, it's teetering back and forth on the verge of going broke. Ditto with Social Security. Now, I've gone back and looked at the initiation period for some of these things. President Kennedy, again, to get back to that Carroll book, President Kennedy had proposed had a Medicare proposal that was pending when he was assassinated, and LBJ, of course, very famously picked up the torch, et cetera. Well, you go back and you look at the debates that were held in that time period, and LBJ was given all these assurances that, well, it would only cost something like, you know, $500 million a year. I mean, it was some sort of absurd figure now. And now you realize that the whole system is teetering back and forth, you know, according to the trustees, the Medicare trustees themselves, and can go under here. And this is the drag on the whole national economy. So clearly, while, you know, my mom has Medicare and you know, all kinds of people have Medicare, what we're doing here is sending the country into a financial hole because of it. So clearly that's not working either.
Let's just move to another subject where I'm sure the callers will take us back to health care. It seems to be front and center today. You wrote recently about Marco Rubio, and I ask, would it be wise for Mitt Romney to put him in the VP slot? If so, why? If not, who should be there?
Yeah, I think he would be a great candidate. And you know, talking about Lyndon Johnson has the distinction of being the only vice presidential candidate really in American history who can definitively be said to have helped elect his presidential candidate, because he carried the state of Texas for JFK, and without that, that was a pretty close election, and he might not have been able to pull it. Now, I think he did some good in southern states as well. I think that just in a purely political aspect, Senator Rubio would bring Florida into the Romney column as well. But I do think he would give some visibility to the immigration issue in a positive sense for Republicans. Again, that's the political take on the whole thing. And, he is, on the face of it, a very attractive, very smart young guy. You know, you look back at the history of these vice presidential selections, Richard Nixon was on that Eisenhower ticket when he was 39 years old. And, you know, some of them worked, some of them didn't. But what always seems to happen, in a lot of cases, these people get on there as a vice presidential pick, and boy, their careers can last forever. They serve as vice president sometimes, and then president. You know, they're an influential voice. I mean, Sarah Palin was on a losing ticket, and she is, at least on the conservative side of the aisle, an extremely influential voice in this. And you can go back, George H.W. Bush, who was Reagan's vice president for, 8 years, president himself, and bequeathed George W. Bush. So, and I remember I was there in the 1980 convention. Ronald Reagan really wanted to put either Jack Kemp or Senator Paul Laxalt from Nevada on as his running mate. He didn't do it. He sort of let himself be led along the line here in terms of George H.W. Bush, and the consequences historically were tremendous. So I think for all those reasons, Rubio would be a good pick. And I should say right there in Wisconsin, you have Paul Ryan, who I think is on the list as well. Again, a youthful guy and very smart and all this, and I understand there's some objection in the Washington circles because they think he's so influential in the Congress that they would rather see him there than his vice president, and take the chance that, what if Romney loses, then he would lose as well. So I don't know, but it's going to be very interesting, and I think Senator Rubio is definitely at the top. You know, it was very interesting when there was a news story from ABC that he was not being vetted. Romney himself personally came out and said, "Oh yes, he is," which I think tells you how popular Senator Rubio is with a sort of base of the Republican Party.
You don't think that President Obama, particularly with his announcement last week, keeping some people from being deported, has the Latino vote pretty much wrapped up?
You know, I don't. I think that this is always a. There's too much, I would suggest, too much in the way of identity politics. And to suggest that all Latinos vote the same way, Senator Rubio is a Cuban-American. Cuban-Americans vote differently than Mexican-Americans.
Yes.
Vote differently than Puerto Rican-Americans, et cetera, et cetera. To say that one is, quote-unquote, Latino is a pretty broad brush there. So do I think he would bring enthusiasm? Do I think Rubio would bring enthusiasm in the Latino community? No question about it. But I think one of his cousins is a Democratic legislator in Nevada. So, the political differences there spread out in the community of Latinos just like they are in a lot of other communities.
Mm. Let's talk about immigration now, because the Supreme Court, this is a brief analysis of it. We'll talk about it more as the week progresses. But SB 1070, Brett writes, is mostly invalidated. But for now, Arizona can have local police check the immigration status of people detained, but the court gave very specific instructions on how to do that in a limited way, which appears to be a win for the Obama administration if we're looking at winners in this.
Right, right. Well, this immigration issue, I mean, this is a nation of immigrants. There is no one, yourself and myself included, who aren't here because, I mean, we're all here because somewhere in the line we had somebody in our family come here, in my case from Ireland and England centuries ago. So the whole nation is filled with immigrants. So I always think it's a misnomer here to, the political thing is to go after Republicans as quote-unquote anti-immigration. All they're saying is they want legal immigration. Now, how you do this, I mean, no country in the world has open borders where people just stream over without passports and all that kind of thing. That's the problem we have. And frankly, if Mexico had a stable government, a good economy, and the situation were reversed, and this were they were all, you know, white guys coming from Canada with French, you know, from Quebec, I think you would still have the same argument going here. And in fact, there are other immigrant groups. I looked this up in spite of my last name sounding so English. On mom's side, we are Irish. And I looked up the Irish situation, and I think I saw that there was something like 50,000 illegal Irishmen in this country. So, you know, it's a much broader issue than just Latinos, and that, I think, is a good discussion to have, and not to get, you know, sort of crazy about it. But it does get politicized heavily, and you get back to the use of the Constitution, the president's executive order on this, and whether he violated the Constitution, and, you know, you get all these other issues here that are, you know, quite serious. So I'll be interested to take a real look at this.
Yes. Yeah, we will as the days go on, too. The core issue in this Supreme Court case is, as you know, whether federal immigration law invalidates state law, whether or not it takes precedence, that was what they were looking at in a large way. What do you think about that? Should it? Do we need federal law to be the supreme law when it comes to immigration?
Yeah, I mean, we're these borders are not just the borders of Arizona. They're the borders of the United States of America. So I myself, I think, would tend to the federal enforcement of immigration law. But, you know, very clearly, I think from the perspective of people in Arizona, the law isn't being enforced. So they took it upon themselves to do it. And obviously, it's as I'm squinting here at the screen, they struck down three sections of the immigration law as unconstitutional, but there apparently were some sections that they passed. So it'll be very interesting to see how they do it, and I'd like to see who voted, you know, which way and what their discussions were and that sort of thing. That's exactly the kind of issue. I don't know what the votes were, but that's exactly the kind of issue that could draw somebody like Justice Scalia to, you know, unconstitutional, you know, that sort of argument.
And the health care decision will be announced on Thursday. We have just...
They're just trying to draw this out to keep us
you
awake.
Got
That's
it.
What they're doing. They like the attention.
Doesn't everybody? So Thursday is the Supreme Court, and we will talk more about immigration and what their ruling is on tomorrow's program. Let's go back to phone calls. Jeffrey Lord is our guest. What an incredibly busy All Things Blue. We got all these decisions happening while we're on the air, and he's watching TV while he's got the sound down, and Brett is trying to answer phone calls and look at the internet at the same time. And yeah, it's there's a lot going on. Jeffrey is a contributing editor for the American Spectator. He has served in high-level positions in both the Reagan and the Bush White Houses. Jim in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. As a judge voter, I've already made my Dred Willard decision because I don't think that he has the empathy or the understanding to meet the needs of the average person in America. And just knowing that, for example, that this guy led a legally blind teacher into a door, and that he also used an officer's uniform to impersonate a police officer in both Michigan and in California, which is a felony, just doesn't give me much faith in him. And beyond that, also, you know, his worry is, for example, that he has an elevator in his home to take his car from one level to another. I've got a 75, I've got a woman at my church who gets by on $75 a month for food. She's a disabled vet, and she has worries about whether we have an elevator in the church to get her to the basement. And this lady received a minuscule Social Security increase, but received a substantial Medicare increase, which of course cuts into her disposable income. And yet, you know, in a national insurance program, the corporate middleman gets paid more than the government administrator does, and administers the same cuts to the person that the administration would. And finally, the lady is not responsible for the fact that the tax breaks to the rich and the needless wars imposed a limitation on the allocation of resources. She didn't have any choice in that matter. It was imposed upon her.
Jeffrey.
Well, I think we're talking to a good liberal Democrat here, and all I would suggest is I bet he did not vote for George Bush instead of John Kerry because George Bush was worth a lot less money than John Kerry. John Kerry, I mean, I used to, earlier in my career, I was executive assistant to the late Senator John Hines, who after he died in a plane crash, his wife Teresa famously married John Kerry. John Kerry, I can personally tell you, is worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 to $700 million. That dwarfs Mitt Romney's net worth infinitely. But I'm guessing that the caller voted for John Kerry and seemed probably not to have much care about that. This is just class warfare, and this is old-fashioned Marxism that somebody's got more than me or you. And you know, it's not about opportunity. I worked for both Ronald Reagan and Jack Kemp. I believe in an opportunity society where we all have the opportunity and we all have empathy for others, but we all have to pitch in. And as JFK said, ask what we can do for our country. And what we can do for our country is go out there and create private sector jobs and work hard and provide these opportunities for other people. You know, being concerned that Mitt Romney has more money than I do is not on my list or I frankly don't think it should be on anybody's list. But if it is on the list, then we need to have a frank discussion about why the John Kerrys and John Kennedys and Franklin Roosevelts were all nominated for president. And to be perfectly candid, you can go all the way back to George Washington, who was a very rich Virginia planter who founded the country. So I think it's not a great argument.
You know, but let me ask more about that, because it seems to me as though John Kerry was also criticized for not having a common touch, that he lived in sort of a rarefied world, and that Romney lives in the same world. And I'm thinking about an interview that we did last week with Colin Powell, and how if you look at those three gentlemen, the one who has the common touch, who is accessible, and I'm convinced could have been president, is Colin Powell. That there's something about, you know, just genuinely taking the president of China to the streets of New York to get a hot dog. You know what I'm talking about, that there's just a connection.
I do, and I should, I guess, you know, fess up here, and I certainly wrote about it. I was not a big Mitt Romney fan during this primary for ideological reasons here. But I understand exactly what you're saying. And, you know, this periodically, John Kerry famously came to Pennsylvania. And when we have the institution of the Philly cheesesteak, which is, you know, finely sliced steak and
right.
hot peppers and onions and all this. This is a big deal in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia in particular. And there's always a place you take your candidate. And he went in there, and you're supposed to have Cheese Whiz on it. This is what makes it, you know, whatever. Well, he asked for Swiss cheese or some, I mean, you know, he just
right, I
right,
know.
Right. It just and this was immediate headlines here.
I know.
right, and so you know, this is a problem. There is no doubt about it. I will fess up to that immediately. But my concern is always, as I've gotten older, is the ideology. Where do they want to take the country? And I think you can be rich, you can be poor, you can be a really great campaigner, you can be stiff as a board. If you're a really great guy and you're going to take the country in the wrong direction, that's not going to help much. So we make do here, and I think there is a problem. I think that Governor Romney's got with this, and I think I saw his wife saying that she needed to chill out or something a little bit because he's not like that in private. You know, some personalities are just like that.
Yeah. Jim, thank you for the call. Willem and Colfax, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment about the health care issue is that I think you can make an argument for a national health care program in the preamble of the Constitution, you know, provide for the common defense and the general welfare. So, but also I think it's disingenuous to suggest that somehow government bureaucrats would be worse than insurance company bureaucrats, which now make these life and death situations, and there are plenty of people who have examples of that. But my main issue is the Republican, in particular, I've contacted our Senator Ron Johnson about my concern because I'm a gardener and I realize that the climate is changing in a very rapid way. And he sent me a letter explaining that that it's an unproven science and world-renowned climate experts dispute it. And when I asked for the name of these world-renowned climate experts, I'm still waiting for his response. And I think that this is a really important issue in it, how it affects our future, the future of our generations, and this idea that we just have to drill our oil is really, if it was our oil, we would have to be a communist country. It belongs to multinational, international corporations. The Chinese are buying huge pieces of, you know, leases on oil land in Canada and all that sort of stuff. So this notion that if we just drill our oil, somehow we'll be paying less money at the pump is, I think, a very disingenuous argument.
Why aren't we paying more attention to climate change, Jeffrey? Should we?
Again, you know, this is not unlike the healthcare issue, although it's a little further down the scale in terms of the kind of attention it gets. But there's a considerable disagreement here over the facts. One of the things that I've always found interesting is that when you listen to Al Gore himself, Al Gore will go on endlessly about how there is a consensus in the scientific community about global warming. Well, you know, there's no consensus in the scientific community about is the Earth round. The Earth is round. That's a fact. That's a scientific fact. There is no consensus about gravity. Gravity exists. Consensus is a political word. It's not a scientific word. Until we reach the day that there is a 100% certifiable scientific set of opinions that there is global warming, this is going to be a topic up for debate. And, of course, to sort of broaden out in the political context, you have a lot of people on the conservative side who just believe this is an excuse to set up one more bureaucracy to do X. And in terms of your caller's question there about bureaucrats versus, you know, insurance companies. With insurance companies, there's competition, and maybe we need to make it. I think we do need to make better. I mean, if I wanted to buy health insurance here in Pennsylvania from a company in, say, Arizona or California because I thought they had a better deal for me, I can't do it. I'm prohibited by the government from doing it. With the government, there is no competition. They say X, that's it. You know, tough, you know, noogies, as it were. So therein lies the difference. But I think that the global warming debate, you know, I'm not far, Penn State lately has, I'm not a graduate of Penn State, but I don't live too far from it. I must say we're in the headlines for a whole set of other reasons that are not very good. But other than that, there was, I think, somebody there involved in this business of global climate data being cooked and all of this kind of thing, and they weren't going to present all the facts and this kind of stuff. The issue itself suffers along those lines. I mean, it pretends to science, and there are a lot of people out there, and there are scientists. I've seen lists. I couldn't give you one, but certainly there are lists out there of people who say this is not science. And as I say, when I hear Al Gore himself say that there's a consensus isn't science, and I think that sort of answers itself.
Jeffrey, let me take issue with you on this issue.
Yeah, sure.
Because I don't think there is considerable disagreement on this particular issue. Hundreds and thousands of scientists all over the world agree that the Earth is heating up. And you're a smart guy. You've met some of these scientists, I'm sure. You'd be hard-pressed to find it being a 50-50 split here. Most scientists believe that, and you're never going to have 100% of everybody agreeing about everything except that we are born and we're going to die. And there are people legitimately who believe that these weird things that we're seeing in weather here, it's really hot. You know, the last few years have been really hot. There have been substantial floods. There are fires taking place. There are animals that don't have habitats anymore. So many scientists are saying that we're seeing the effects of global warming. And by golly, if we don't do something, if we wait for 100% agreement, which will never happen, we are in trouble.
Well, I guess I just respectfully disagree with you. I mean, there has to be 100% agreement on science. I mean, science is science. It's not politics. It's not anything else. I mean, if we're going to send, for example, people into space, we have to have an understanding of what the Earth looks like. And we all understand the Earth is round, there's gravity, et cetera. to you know, if you've got people saying, well, gee, that's not really true, the Earth is flat, and there is no such thing as gravity, then those astronauts would be dead, you know, almost immediately, because the science would be wrong. So science, at least as I was taught as a kid, has got to be 100% totally accurate, and everybody has to, you know, I mean, it's fact. If you stray from that, then you're not dealing with science. You're dealing with politics, and there may well be all sorts of things going on here. But there are plenty of scientists out there who will say, well, you know, we're taught that there's a difference between weather and climate and all of this kind of thing. I mean, I just think that it is so unsettled here that that's why, in a political sense, you're not, at least yet, going to get to any kind of agreement about what to do. If you can't agree, if people can't agree, at least with healthcare, they agree what the problem is. I don't think people understand what the problem is here with climate change. And I think that the very fact that it's gone from being called global warming to climate change, that, you know, we had, what, Newsweek magazine back in the 70s saying that we were entering a new ice age and all this stuff. I mean, this is pretty damaging to people who want to say there's a real science, there's real solid science for this.
Let's welcome our phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. Jeffrey Lord is our guest this hour, contributing editor for American Spectator, served in both the Reagan and Bush White Houses, and we're talking all things political this hour, a busy week. It is 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. And the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday, we'll talk about the independent film Water Walk, which was shot largely in Wisconsin, and it tells the fascinating story of a father and son who set out to recreate the Marquette and Joliet storied canoe voyage across Lake Michigan, down the Fox and Wisconsin Rivers, down the Mississippi to St. Louis, Missouri. The movie is based on the memoir Water Walk, A Passage of Ghosts by Stephen Faulkner. And we'll be speaking to Faulkner, as well as the director and star of the film, Bob Cecchini. So that's coming up hour two. Let's go back to phone calls for Jeffrey. We have a few minutes left. Let's go to Don in Racine County. Hi, Don.
Hi there. I just wanted to pass along a comment, Jeffrey's comment about the climate change. When Jeffrey says that you have to have 100% among consensus among scientists, 100% agreement for something to be true, you never have that. Science doesn't work that way. Science is somebody proposes something, you try to replicate the results, and science works by disproving. So there's never going to be 100% agreement on something like climate change. There's always going to be alternative theories being tossed about, and that's healthy for science. But I find a problem that a lot of conservative friends of mine think like Jeffrey does. They think that, in absolutist terms. And this kind of fits in with other ways they look. For instance, the idea of universal health care being unconstitution. When we had the guys who wrote the Constitution, did the Disabled Seamen's Act, so which mandated health coverage for sailors because the health risks, it was kind of a workers' comp program. So, but it was mandated. So anyway, I'd like to hear Jeffrey's comments off. I got to get off the air here. I'm walking into work. Thank you.
You're walking in the woods. Okay, Jeffrey.
Well, I have to say I haven't heard of the Disabled Seamen's Act, and I'll look it up. You know, you learn something new every day, and I will be happy to take a check on that. But again, I just have to disagree. I mean, I understand. I took, you know, chemistry and physics and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, that's why I went into politics, because I'm not a chemist or a physicist. But it's abundantly clear that you test propositions and all of this kind of thing. But when you're going to make major decisions here, when you're going to tell a business, for example, that they can't do X, it's going to cost them millions and millions of dollars in cost, I might add, you know, all kinds of jobs, like the coal industry in West Virginia, for example, or, you know, I live right down the road from Three Mile Island. It's about, you know, I can see it every day when I drive across the bridge to Harrisburg. You know, you've got to know exactly what you're dealing with here. Otherwise, you are asking people to spend all kinds of money to deny people jobs, employment, et cetera, because of suppositions that may or may not be accurate. And, you know, you don't go in to have an operation and the doctor says, you know, gee, I thought you had the measles, but it turns out you've got cancer. You know, it doesn't work that way. I mean, they need to know the basics here of the science. And I don't know how else to say that. I just think that is a must here. And we do have, I mean, you know, anybody who believes that they can jump off the top of the Empire State Building without a parachute and survive, good luck to them. But I'm willing to bet that the science is 100% that they're not going to make it.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us. Happy birthday to your mom.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. And that healthcare debate will continue.
Yes, it will. Thank you. Jeffrey Lord, our guest this hour for All Things Political, contributing editor for American Spectator, served in the Reagan White House, served in the George Bush White House as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Brett Jaspers for keeping track of lots of things this hour, what was going on in the Supreme Court and the phone calls and all of that. We will no doubt be doing a show on the Supreme Court's decision on Arizona's immigration law tomorrow. So thanks for listening.